Good afternoon. We are prepared to resume our meeting with an enhancement. So hopefully, with these microphones, you'll be able to hear better back there. We apologize for the low volume earlier today, and perhaps these mics will help make it possible for everybody in the audience to hear. Before we go on with our afternoon's agenda, I think Stephen has something he wants to bring up.
Thank you, Commissioner. I mentioned earlier today this brochure called Johnson Woods. It was prepared by all the caucuses that participated in the five-year extension of RMAP policy work we did on that. One of the outcomes of that was the notion that we needed to get more money to accelerate the process of replacing fish passage on small forest landowners' land, and also start helping the counties deal with fish passage barriers on their thing. So we have put a brochure together and identified an amount for the FY12 federal budget, and we're currently trying to schedule meetings with different congressional with our congressional delegation to get the word out. So I will pass these around to all of you and recommend that if any of you are in certain congressional territories and willing to visit your particular member, let myself or Aaron Everett, who is leading this for DNR, know, and we can coordinate. And thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen. So moving on with this afternoon's agenda now, compliance monitoring biannual report. Walt, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and board members. I'm Walt Obermeyer. I'm currently managing the compliance monitoring program. And to get things going here, today we're going to talk about the 2008-2009 results from the compliance monitoring program. The highlights, you've got more detail in the reports for that earlier. I want to hear today kind of a little bit about the sampling process and some of the results, a few particular things about riparian features, and some conclusions. So for 2008-2009, we sampled 333 different applications in four different samples. There's the alternate plan, or the standard sample, which was 187 FPAs, and there were three other smaller samples targeted at the specific features of alternate plans, exempt 20-acre parcels, and wetlands. Not there yet. Okay. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. The FPA, I talk a little bit about the sampling itself. There, we have the FPAs that form the basis of the sample design. They're the highest level population, and they're randomly selected, so it's an unbiased selection of FPAs. The activities are kind of the subpopulations that are clustered within the FPA, and they are comprised of things like roads, prescriptions along F-type water, prescriptions along NP-type water. And those aren't enumerated specifically in FPA, so that they have to be tied back to the highest level population, which is the FPA. And we sample only activities which are associated with riparian features or road activities. The program set out on that course earlier to sample two things that were deemed important, which was water and the road construction. And so that was what the sample is limited to. We don't do things like marble burlets or wildlife relief trees. And only one activity of each activity type is sampled on each FPA. If we have one desired future condition, one option on, if there are more than one PFC option one on a application, we only sample one of those. It's also a difference this year, or this biennium from the previous biennium. There was concern about, well, they looked at the compliance with the activity. This year we looked at both the compliance with the activity and the compliance with the rule itself. And so this came up where each activity we looked at had several possible outcomes, and I'm going to go through these. And so it counts, so you'll get some which have different counts of totals. You'll have the compliance with the rule for, say, MPs. The compliance with the rule may be a few short of those, but the ones, the compliance with the application. And I'll describe that here. And looking at, say, the top bar there, where we looked at the 30-some-odd road construction applications, 25 of them were found to be compliant with both the application and the rule. About five of them were found to be out of compliance with both the application and the rule. And then you have two that were compliant with the application, but out of compliant with the rule, and one that was out of compliant with the application, but compliant with the rule. And so that adds a little bit of intrigue to the way we have to summarize the data. But the results are pretty much are very similar to 2006 and 2007. There was really no statistical difference between the biennium. They varied. The riparian mean compliance was slightly up to 78% from 75%. And the roads activities mean compliance was down somewhat from 279% from 87%. But both by any means are within the confidence intervals, and the differences aren't really significant. And the report really wasn't published from 2006-2007, wasn't published till after we started the work on 2006 to 2008. So what it does is, the program does well structured to address the problem of what is the compliance rate, but it doesn't provide a very good basis to go in and fix something once you see there's a problem, because we've got this lag time in between, and the program will be addressing that in the future. So looking at the summary compliance, the primary rates between riparian and road, 78-79%, the totals for all landowner types. There's not really statistical difference between the small landowners and the large landowners, either for road or riparian. And so it's very similar all the way across. There are no differences detected out of the sample size for the standard sample. Looking at the riparian activities, we looked at a number of different ones. With the Western Washington No Winter Zone Harvest, they're all fairly, the type F&S water here was generally a little lower than the average. The average for it was around in here, about 79-80%. These came out lower as a rule. Eastern Washington type F and S water came out a little bit higher than Western, but sample size on some of these are quite small. For the DFC option one, sample size was 10. You see the large error bars, but the 50% rate for compliance is still rather striking. The no entry and no winter zone harvests still are a little low. The no winter zone harvest is the better of those two, and that's where there's the option is to leave reef trees, or not cut in the inner zone, but leave the trees that are 20 trees, 12 inches and larger, and so that compliance was down a little bit low. DFC option two was considerably better than the other type F strategies. Type NS was relatively high, somewhere in the mid-90s. The type NPs dropped down to about 70. And I'll go through the reasons for this in a little bit. Wetlands was up high, and this kind of matches what was done in the wetlands, matches what was shown in the wetlands emphasis sample. Salvage is a very small sample size, and some differences there. Looking at riparian activities by landowner group, again, not much difference. For the roads, they generally hovered right around 80%. Not much difference between the industrial and the small landowners. Road abandonment for the best of the group at...
excuse me, Walt. Dave, did you have a question?
Just clarifying, where you have a really small sample size, is that kind of the whole population? Is that the whole...
That's out of the 333 187 applications, that's how many showed up.
So they were random. It was random.
It's random. This is, landings were only, it's not quite random. This, landings were only selected where they were placed in a position that could possibly deliver. A landing on a ridge drop where, it, and this is for roads too, landing on a ridge drop doesn't get evaluated.
So that's seven maybe the whole.
That is the whole, yeah. All of what we mean. So going on to the emphasis sample, wetlands, 20 acre exempt to the alternate plants. The wetlands had a pretty good sample size of 197. I'm sorry, the population was 197. The sample size is 69. These are fairly robust samples for these emphasis, considering that with 8,300 apps and the standard sample being about 200 apps for the period is considerably less of a proportion. Same way with the 20-acre exempts, we measured over half of those and a little over half of the alternate plants. And the results are, for wetlands, generally running about 90% with the wetlands, A, being a little short for compliance with the rule. And that's how that came out. As a result, they came out much better than the averages for the across the state and the standard sample. For the 20-acre exempt at alternate plans, that was a bit different story. The alternate plans scored in the mid-80s, and the 20-acre exempts scored in the mid-60s. Looking at this, these were also evaluated only with the application. Alternate plans don't really have a rule associated with them because the alternate plan is an opportunity for a landowner to adjust the practice to provide the needed protection, but in a variance to the rules. 20-acre exempts are different. The rules are set up, but they're less constrained. But yet, in this case, the 20-acre exempts had a 63% compliance rate. This category, other activities assessed, looks at other activities that occurred in conjunction with the applications selected for the 20-acre exempt and alternate plants. And those activities were about at the average for the standard sample. So it didn't look like there's split. Maybe it says that there's more likely something different about the 20-acre exempts and the alternate plants than standard activities. We also did, in this biennium, a supplemental water information form. There was enough concern expressed in the previous measurement that the water typing is subject to should be subject to some more review. And so we looked at a number of different categories here. The NS features we looked at 26 of them out of 84 in the sample because they looked different. What we generally found was they tended not to be water at all. Rather than going up from this, the count of those going up to NP was one, the count of them going to none was seven. So NP was the alternative of the 89, of the 30 we looked out of the 89, 21 of them showed some features consistent with the F, and only one of them went to an NP category, showing that there's a tendency to move up there in classification.
Can I ask a question, please? Clarify that. Could you back up to that one as well? I may have missed this before. The in any of the rows there, I'll take the top one. Reviewed 26 out of the 84.
Right.
What was the criteria for that review?
Was whether the team got out there and they looked at the water feature and they said, this is not what the applicant, this has evidence that there might be something not consistent with the rules. And so.
And the others were assumed then to be correct.
The others were looked at, and then by that judgment were deemed, yeah, this is correct. We have no basis to challenge that.
Thank you.
On map features, we did go out and find some features that were not on the map or the application, and we looked at 12 of those for the NS or MPs. Usually, two went to, we found that were actually type Fs. Bank full widths had some differences. I better move along here. The water type break differences of where it's more, the position of the break between water tanks was different than located on the maps. So let's look at now at some Western Washington no RNZ harvest. We looked at the riparian, not the riparian, but the non-compliance ratings when we developed the when we sampled. So we made a professional judgment whether it was the compliant, out of compliance was of low severity, medium, or major severity. And looking at both rural and harvest compliance for Western Washington, you'll see some differences throughout here, but generally the rural compliance was a little bit better for the no harvest RNZ than it was for the FDA compliance. And that's because the...
Excuse me, Stephen?
Can you please clarify on what exactly we're talking about here? Is this RMZs that for whatever reason the core zone, the, of course the core zone, but the inner zone was not entered, and so you're measuring compliance with the outer edge of the inner zone? Is that what this represents?
No RMZ harvest represents, there's a type F within the bounds of the application, but the landowners said on the application that they weren't going to operate any closer than 200 feet to it. So they left essentially the plan was to leave the entire riparian width undone. And so what you see here on the harvest compliance with the FDA is, did they leave that reach entirely untouched? They did half the time, 29%. They took a small amount, probably from the outer zone, and then 14% of the time they either got into the inner zone or the core zone. I don't remember any of the core zones in there. Probably some inner zone trees were taken.
Okay, just to follow up on that, Walt. So I'm a little confused. I understand the 50% compliance rate, but of the pie chart, part of the pie chart that's supposed to be assumedly out of compliance, is it really out of compliance, or is it because on the app they said they weren't going to go within 200 feet and they went within 200 feet? So the question is, can you go within 200 feet and still be compliant with the rules?
Yeah, and this chart shows that.
Okay.
Because in here we've got better than 57%, not much better, like one application. But still, the rule showed that they weren't going, that they may have left the trees sufficient to, the minimum prescription is the no inner zone harvest, where you leave the the 20 trees per acre, 12 inches diameter in the outer zone. So this is probably showing that they took down below the 12 trees per acre in the outer zone. I'm not going to say it, but somewhere in there they took some trees that were not according to the rules. If you like detail, I would follow up with you on that.
That's good, thank you.
Western Washington, no winter zone harvest. Compliance was better. The 50% were completely compliant. And that 12 to 13% you see in this category, those actually exceeded compliance level. We have an exceeds rating where the activity provides 20% more trees or protection than provided for under the rule. And so 2% were majorly out of compliance, 21%. And 21% minor means really trivial, where you're maybe taking a couple of trees out of the inner zone or something like that. So that's how that's judged. Desired tree control. PSC option one, again, 50% compliance. And it's fairly consistent between FPA compliance and rule compliance. Desired future conditions. Two, leaving trees closest to the water. Did considerably better at 80%, but still had a major non-compliance. You know, something that was quite apparent and that is either delivering or causing loss of protection, significant loss of protection. Eastern Washington, fairly similar. Well, not so many majors. And the no winter zone harvest, 75% either compliant or exceeding. Western Washington type NPs, again, 59-60%, about 70%. Not too many major non-compliance issues associated with it. Probably somewhere where several trees are missing or the encroachment into the 50-foot buffer. Type NP east side. Some of the concluding remarks and say is that there's no statistical difference between the last time, 79% versus 80%. The review of the stream classification attributes indicates that we got problems with the water data as reported on the FPA. We're going to take a look at that in this coming year. There's just too much difference there to pass without some real action. The comparison of rule and FPA compliance indicates it's fairly consistent between the FPA and the rule compliance. Much of the riparian non-compliance can be addressed with the attention to measure the area measurements with the leaf tree stockings. What I found was that there are a lot of these applications where the stream length is mismeasured. And where if it's measured shorter, that will produce a stand table if they have to leave, particularly on DFC1, where they leave so many trees per acre. If they don't have enough acres calculated and they leave so many trees, they're going to be way under. And this is a fairly consistent theme throughout the DFC and the NP zones. And so we'll be looking at the stream lengths in the future, or asking staff to look at those as they come in on the application.
Well, just a quick question on that. What kind of differences did you guys see out there in terms of length?
Yeah, we measured the stream length over the course of the reach within the application. And sometimes we measure a considerably longer distance than the applicant put on the application. And so that means there's more acreage to protect.
Right. I'm just wondering about, in, maybe after we're done, we can talk about board manual. Is it clear? Is it unclear? Kind of where some improvements might be.
So, what we want to address in the future is, I'd like to get on top of the watertight dressing by performing some reviews of recently approved applications, but where they haven't been completed. So, as watertight modification forms come in, we get out there as the compliance monitoring team and takes a look at those to see if we can assess those right after the team looks at them. I'm a little concerned coming back two to four years after these, the adoption of the watertight modifications, depending on weather conditions, and that things can happen that time. So I want to make sure that what we're looking at, we're measuring the same thing. And then design some samples to focus on providing more timely feedback on whether actions been taken to address these non-compliance issues are actually working. So,
that complete your report?
Yeah, just some acknowledgments that I missed in the written report, but for the compliance monitoring folks that work with me in the agencies and the compliance monitoring stakeholder team. So that concludes my report.
All right, thank you, Walt. Board, I think it's important to recognize a couple of issues right here to begin with. First of all, this is our second compliance report. And also the fact that these rules have now been in existence for roughly 10 to 12 years. So you can imagine when you first get started with new rules that compliance is maybe going to be a little uneven. But it is my hope and expectation that we can improve upon this considerably. And I want to assure the board that we at DNR intend, and our goal is to reach 100% compliance, much as Peter Heide mentioned this morning. And I'm pleased to hear that the industry also has the same goal. It's also important to note that this compliance report includes data up and through, I believe, July of 09, is that correct, or to the 1st of July?
To the 1st of July.
So to the 1st of July. So it's roughly a year and a half stale. And I apologize for that. We simply must do a better job of preparing our compliance reports in a more timely fashion, so that we can use the results of the report to do a better job. Now, we have two data points now. We have the 07-09, basically, and the 08-09. So we have two data points from which to go. And as Walt has pointed out, there's really no statistical difference between them. And from discussions with staff, it's also clear that there were some adjustments made, but maybe not big adjustments made to the program as a result of the prior report, perhaps due in part to the fact that it was just one data point. But now we have two data points, and as Walt and others have pointed out, it provides us with an opportunity to be thoughtful about how we approach the results of this compliance report to be better. It's also apparent that we need to decrease the period of time between when the data is gathered and when we actually get the report. And I think I'm going to ask staff to provide this board with an annual report, not a biannual report, but an annual report. And I've also tasked staff with coming back to me within a month with a plan as to how to use this data together with the previous report's data to come back with recommendations for my consideration about ways that we can improve compliance across the landscape. And it would be my hope and expectation that a year from now, we would either have another annual report or an interim report to bring back to this board to let you know how our adjustments to our Forest Practices Division and how those rules are implemented across the landscape to ensure compliance. I think it's obvious to everybody on the board. I know it's obvious to the landowners out there that there are a lot of very complex issues involved in not only the forest practice applications themselves and being compliant with the application, but also being compliant with the underlying rule. There are not always clear distinctions about exactly what's compliant and what's not compliant. And to the degree that we can sharpen those distinctions, perhaps through the board manual or other vehicles, to help along the way, I think that will be to everyone's advantage to make sure that we fully enforce the rules as best as we possibly can. I want to make one caveat here, and that is earlier today you heard in my report to you the budgetary reductions that we took in the Forest Practices Division, the last biennium, and the fact that we're staring at additional reductions. These staff reductions have real impacts across the program and its ability to carry out these very complex duties in both a timely and a complete manner. So what happens as a result, and I'm being very direct with you here, as a result of this legislative session, will have a direct impact on our capacity to be able to fully enforce the rules. So thanks again, Walt. I'm sure members of the board would have questions.
Walt, in your compliance monitoring, do you have any way for noting people who exceed?
To recognize them individually?
Yes. I mean, do you, because I know there are small landowners, I'll speak for small landowners, that do more than what's required. Do you note that at all?
We note it on the review, and if the landowner wants a copy of the review, they can get it. But we don't really go through and categorize by individual. I'm a little reluctant to do that because it's a sample, and so you're not going to get everybody. We're taking a random sample, fairly small sample of that, and I'm thinking that might not adequately be representative if you're looking to give commendation to individuals like that to exceed the rules. So no, we don't.
Your standard, you meet the standard, or you're below the standard. Basically, is what
the review will state whether that application has exceeded the standard. So that activity has exceeded the standard. So if the landlord gets a copy of the review, if they request a copy, they will see that on there. They've exceeded it.
Dave?
But your report does have a category for exceeds, so that where they're about to exceed, it did show that.
Yeah, it'll show that on the review form that we complete in the field.
More than a question, we had some recommendations about the mistyping stream this morning in the Conservation Caucus, and I'd like us to figure out as a board how to direct that we get some recommendations for action. How are we going to address the issues?
Well, I've told you, Dave, I hope the board heard me clearly, that, of course, water typing was a major issue in the compliance report. And so I'm directing staff to not only come back and work with me, but we will come back and report in May about those recommendations and how the agency can improve compliance in all the different areas that have been identified in the report.
Thank you.
Steven?
Thank you.
Steven?
Thank you, Commissioner. So I really appreciate the work that folks have done to get this out. I'm going to wander a little bit and then try and come back. First of all, Commissioner, thank you for committing to coming back to the board and identifying a path forward so that we have good feedback. We can figure out what the problem is if we have a problem. And hopefully, with putting those actions in place, we'll see results in the next compliance survey. Couple of things that I find interesting with the statistics that have been provided. One is landings. Given the small sample size, I don't know how much fodder you can put in that, and I guess that would be a question as well for staff at some point, is how small a sample size can you have and it still means something? And that landings, we've had rules on landings for 30 years probably. I don't know how far back that one goes. Type A wetlands, we've had those rules since 92. And so I find it interesting that that's the lowest compliance in the wetlands group. I find it really interesting that there's no difference between smaller large landowners, because you would think the industrial guys who do this every day as part of their job and many times know the rules better than some of the rest of us would show a higher compliance, right? So that tells me something about the survey or something, and the fact that, you know, the small landowner office, which has had most of its technical assistance stripped from it, we're not seeing any difference. So that's just an interesting observation. The other thing that we have in our clean water assurances that we really want to seek to get in future compliance monitoring is to have a better understanding of where we have non-compliance, where that is on the landscape or in the region or so, because, for example, on a type A wetland, if we're having non-compliance problems, is it associated with a type A wetland out on the peninsula, which looks a lot different than, say, a type A wetland on the east side of the state? And so without having any, be able to disaggregate this data into ecoregions of the state or administrative regions of the state, it's really difficult to sort of get at the problem. And so I would hope in the future we could get there. That's one of our milestones. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for those observations. Other questions?
Really more observation than question. As Pete Heine mentioned in his testimony, and certainly my goal that as landowners we achieve 100% compliance. That is what we are aiming for. And in essence, what we got was about 90% that either met or were barely below that full compliance level, which is certainly not what we want to see, but at least is an indication that we don't have big, big problems to have to be dealing with. Again, I'd like it to be 100, and we'll continue to work towards that. At least a portion of that which was not achieved has been pointed out in the report, and I think we need to recognize that as David started asking the question about, can we find ways in which the implementation of those rules can be done consistently so that compliance monitoring is actually evaluating the same thing that the forester that laid the harvest unit road, whatever it is measuring to. And there are certain areas within the rules that are more subjective and certain things that are quite objective and easy and would be consistent. I think that it would be well for us to just, whether it's a small task group or something, to talk about those things where we might be able to find some minor modifications to the way in which rules are implemented can be then consistent with the way in which they are monitored for compliance. And the objective, of course, is maintaining the same level of protection. I'm not talking about changing protection areas or standards, but can we find ways that are a little bit more simple to work with? And we would certainly commit to being involved in that.
All right. Thank you. Other questions or suggestions?
I just wanted to ask a quick clarifying question on what Norm just said. So are you talking about actual clarification in rule language where it's less than clear about what a landowner is supposed to do, and if that language was clarified, that compliance would likely be easier?
It may be in rule language. It could be board manual language. There are a number of ways in which we could, I think, improve that. And in, you know, keeping in mind that we all have a job to do as well, though we don't need to be out there with scientific instruments, any of us, measuring either implementation or compliance, if we can avoid that. Because the variances that we might find probably aren't warranted by the additional or less resource protection that would be achieved.
So if I can suggest, I mean, we'll get a staff report back in May about what staff's evaluation of the report indicate, that how we as an agency and a board can work together to achieve that higher compliance. So let's wait until we get that, and then we can have a discussion about what rules we're going to play in that.
Yeah, thanks, Walt. Appreciate the report, the PowerPoint. You know, this is a really important program. I think everybody is speaking to that. And we certainly recognize DNR staffing issues. And it's really, it's great to hear that the staff's going to come back and kind of give us an update on how these certain issues will be addressed. I'm not sure which ones the staff is going to try to address. Sorry, Scott. Not sure which issues or to what length and depth the staff can start addressing these things, but there are a number of topics that we talked about: stream typing, the feedback loop that you spoke of, type A wetlands and landings, and those kinds of things. So that's really good. I'm anxious to hear some more progress on that. One thing that the thought that crossed my mind, Commissioner, when you spoke of an annual report, is I've heard that, and I would expect that putting together a report like this would take a lot of time and effort. And so is that achievable in a one-year time frame without taking away time and effort towards the normal everyday runnings of the compliance monitoring program and being able to do sub-samples like the targeted or whatever you call them, like the 20-term exams and alternate plans and those kinds of things? Because I think those kinds of things may also become more important to address Stephen's concern about, are there regional differences, statewide differences, whatever it may be. So I'm interested to understand how DNR, or if you can do that, to what extent will it take away from normal compliance monitoring efforts?
Well, I think it's early to try and answer that, although I appreciate your concern there, Dave. But I think it's obvious if you kind of look at this from a logical standpoint. This report identifies major areas where there are issues, if I can put it that way. And that if we look at those issues where the resource is most at risk and focus perhaps on those, a limited number of those at first, and do an interim report that's probably not going to be as complete as this, but will hopefully at least address the major issues where the resource is most at risk, maybe not around those minor discrepancies, but maybe focusing on the major and medium areas and trying to resolve those first and foremost. But I'm sure that we can work with staff and come up with a better model than what we're operating under now. Again, a year and a half. I mean, I appreciate all the effort that went into this, but I'm sure you can understand my interest in finding a way to to work on a shorter timeline so that we can be more effective in reaching what we all know to be our collective goal, and that is to get to 100% compliance in a reasonable period of time.
Right. In the course of the 6 months in building this report, I've noticed and I've learned a lot, and I've made some changes in the data structures that will make future reporting considerably easier.
Good. So give us a chance to respond to your concerns. Okay. Give us a chance to come back and present some ideas. Your suggestions will of course be always considered at that time. Yes,
Norm. Just one other clarifying comment, and maybe a comment to a clarifying question. Walt, if there was an FBA that had been identified as having had a violation, and this is in the file, would that have been included in the sample?
Yes.
Okay. It could potentially have been included.
Right.
Okay. I just wanted to see if that was part of the numbers. And it leads a little bit to the comment that you made, Commissioner, that certainly those things that are considered to be major, call it a violation, because that's really what it is of the rule, major out of compliance area, those are definitely things that we want to be sure that we focus on. And whether through the existing compliance, not monitoring, but the compliance enforcement efforts of the department, that certainly those things should be caught and dealt with in all of the ways in which the DNR has the authority to do so. And then, of course, to find improvements on those things that are, I would guess, are much more accidental. They're still violations, but they're accidental. Whereas some of the major ones, I would guess, maybe at least could be considered to be a lot less than accidental.
Well, we'll do whatever we can to bring those numbers down and bring them closer to our goal. So with that, thank you all for your presentation. It's been very informative. So moving on to our next item on this afternoon's agenda, forest biomass review. Again, I think I'd provide a few introductory remarks to this particular section. I think you all know that just a little later in the agenda, we're going to consider some rulemaking that we initiated at the last regular meeting. We all know from comments that were made during general testimony that this is an issue that has received some scrutiny or some interest by the public. I think it's very important for this board to understand that we at DNR are seriously interested in sustainable management of our lands and making sure that all rules are complied with, and that wherever we have the opportunity, we want to make sure that the ecology of our forested landscape is maintained. And that when we consider forest biomass going forward, we must consider ways to make sure that the operations, whether on public land or private land, are done in a way that preserves the ecological health of the forest. So I know Bridget is going to come forward now and talk about a task that I asked her to engage on as a result of the discussion we had at the last regular board meeting about not only rulemaking, which we are going, as I said, later today to consider further rulemaking on making forest biomass a forest practice, but also to start to engage the different groups about concerns relative to potential rulemaking or management practices or whatever steps need to be taken to ensure the health of the forest floor going forward. So, Bridget, please give us a report on your work.
Sure. Good afternoon, Commissioner and members of the board. I'm here to talk about, as a follow-up to Commissioner's remarks about forest biomass. As a result of the last board meeting, Commissioner directed staff to convene a meeting to discuss what was underway with the existing rulemaking regarding forest biomass and try to identify what particular concerns individuals may have to queue up for any future rulemaking, board manuals, or whatever the next phase is as we move forward on biomass. We did that. We had a meeting about a week and a half ago. We convened a group of stakeholders, which would have included WFPA, Forest and Fish Caucus, Conservation Caucus members, the Federal Services, Fish and Wildlife, Ecology, DNR, Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, and a couple of representatives from the Conservation Caucus. Small landowners were invited but couldn't make it at that meeting. At that meeting, my intent was to provide an update on the DNR forest biomass supply assessment, which is a separate assessment that's going on at the University of Washington. We had our biomass specialist attend the meeting and provide an update to the committee, to the group, excuse me. We then talked about what is going on with the existing rulemaking, and Mark's going to talk about that in a few minutes, but in essence, the addition of the definition of biomass in forest practices definitions would then ensure that any activity related to biomass retrieval would be considered forest practice, and then all the rest of the rule set would come along with it. So Mark walked through that a little bit with the group to clarify what exactly the change in the rules was that was going on right now. And then we moved into a conversation about what the potential concerns might be from different entities. And that was a lively discussion, as you can imagine. The conversation really kind of focused around a few different perspectives, all of which I think really come down to the comments that the commissioner made at the beginning, which is what is the appropriate amount of material that can be removed to ensure the ecological health of the forest remain. And so many different perspectives kind of raise that or ask that question, but coming from different perspectives. One of the sort of places where the conversation had different perspectives was really around what the current state of the technology and the economics are now versus what they may be in the future, and whether whether we have time now to be thoughtful, gather information, evaluate what's going on, and then based on that information, and bring information back to the board and contemplate next steps, or whether the board should take a different type of approach and take a proactive approach now in a precautionary way to ensure that industries weren't already constructed, have a huge capital investment, maybe jobs created, and that folks would feel that the economics would sort of get away from them, and that the board or the state might be more in a defensive position. So there were a lot of different positions and different perspectives on that, as far as how fast that might happen, or how, you know, what it would take for the economics to shift to make more aggressive, if you will, biomass harvest, something that might happen in the state. So we had a lively discussion about that. We then sort of asked folks to lay out specifically what their concerns were, and had a list of those, but in essence they came down to a couple of things, which is really what that question of, if you have all the rules in place, including the one that you're about to contemplate of making biomass a forest practice, if those are all in place, and a landowner goes out and harvests to the maximum that they're legally allowed to, what does it look like on the landscape? So that seems to be the main particular question that I think most folks had wanted an answer to. And so we agreed through that group that we would do a few things. One is make sure that anybody else who had an interest in participating could at the next discussion, which is not scheduled yet, to ensure that some of the biomass production facility, or the biomass industrial folks would participate. So from their end of the capital investment and business side, we could have their perspective as well. They weren't there. We agreed to keep talking and to build off of the literature review that's underway right now at the University of Washington as part of our supply assessment, and share that with everybody. We would agree to evaluate what the current rules provide and monitor the activities. Now, once forest biomass gets included as a forest practice, then we will capture all of those activities, and so we can monitor those activities across the landscape through our normal forest practice tracking. So we agreed to do that. We also agreed that there was a learning opportunity that we probably all needed to embark upon, which would be to either do a tour of some of the operations that are underway with possibly some willing landowners, and then and or conduct maybe a science day to have some of the folks that are engaged in the science, whether through the University of Washington or other places, come down and meet with our group so that we can have a really in-depth understanding of what the state of the science is, because there are many questions that are not answered, but it'd be nice to know how far things have been answered to date. And then finally would be to bring what we learned back to the board for future thoughts about next steps.
Thank you, Bridget. Questions from the board? Yes, Paul.
Did you have a sense of timing? Like how many more meetings do you think you would have with this group, and at what point do you feel like you would be ready to bring recommendations back to the board?
My understanding, not definitively, quick answer, but my understanding that the literature review, the entire supply study will be done at the end of the summer. That's my understanding. And so we should be able to get the literature review portion of that a little earlier and then have a conversation with the group about that. My thought would be the field day would be something that we would want to do likely after session, just given our many of us don't have a very long tether at this point to get out of Olympia to go and do that, and I think that would really benefit the group. I know it would me personally, so I expect that to be in the late spring, but I would expect that we would be meeting, you know, between now and then as well to really kind of formulate what these questions are, if we're going to have scientists join us, and just to kind of continue the dialogue about the different perspectives, because the temperature kind of went up and down, and I think the more we can talk through them and understand the different points of view, the better the process will go.
All right, one more. Dave?
Just real quickly. Thanks, Bridget. The discussion, I think, at the meeting was, I thought it was very healthy, and I got a lot out of it, the varying perspectives. It's good to hear you say that, you know, once, assuming the rule passes, something will be added to the FPA so that DNR and others can track the biomass operations, whether they're separate operations or in conjunction with other types of activities or harvests. It's probably too early, but has DNR had any discussions about whether or not, forest practice foresters, how they may look at those apps in the field in terms of prioritization of getting out there on the ground pre or during harvest or whatever it is? And I only ask that because, there are a lot of biomass operations that are going on now, and they're not, they're just taking the slash off the landings and the piles and all that kind of stuff. And then I've also heard that there are some operations that haven't gone quite so well, and maybe thus the need for the rule. So do you have a sense for how DNR may prioritize field visits and just kind of compliance checks, so to speak, on biomass, because it is such a hot topic?
Not a definitive plan that I can report to you today, but I can tell you that given the hot topic nature that comes along with it, it's something that we're going to look at. We're in the process right now of working with all of our regional offices on our deliverables in our budgeting process, and in so doing, we're trying to identify specific deliverables, whether they're pieces that might be helpful to the discussion you just had on compliance monitoring, and I think this folds into that same discussion. So it's timely because we're actively having that conversation right now, so I think we'll fold this into that. But it is something that we intend to track and try to gather a lot of information on.
All right, thank you, Bridget. And with that, the next item on this afternoon's agenda is an opportunity for public comment on forest biomass rulemaking. And I would hope that members of the public who are commenting on this will target their comments to the rulemaking before the board at the current time. So with that, Peter Goldman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Goldman, and the Washington Forest Law Center, and I'm not representing the Conservation Caucus here. I'm representing the Olympic Forest Coalition. Thank the board for convening the first round, phase one of the rulemaking for biomass. As Bridget said, we're committed to working with this group to address what's necessary in phase two. May I just clarify the board chair? Are you saying you are not accepting any comment relative to the phase two at this point?
Well, what is our action item? The whole purpose, Peter and members of the audience, for these opportunities to comment right ahead of board action is to comment about the proposed board action. And that's why we've done this. If you have comments relative to future actions, then it may have been more appropriate at an earlier time.
Well,
because I'm trying to make this whole process work for the board and for you. So do you comment on what we're about to do?
It was, Bridget just made a presentation summarizing a group that's convening to guide this board and the DNR in the next step. Mm-hmm. So we have some comments on how phase one ought to dovetail into phase two.
Fine. Make your comments. Just please be adhered to the 3-minute
process. Okay. Thank you. Right now, as I said, we're looking at the phase two issue right now. We call it Return of the Dead Wood. We're going to name a movie about this. OFCO is committed to working with this group and have asked Miguel Perez Gibson and me to represent them in the process. And other organizations are looking at this as well, including Conservation Northwest, Washington Environmental Council, the Sierra Club. Our approach is one of science and precautionary principle and good policy. Our involvement is not based on a categorical opposition to forest biomass collection and incineration. Our focus is on the impacts on forests, not necessarily the impacts on CO2. Or public health, although those are entirely legitimate public concerns, and I don't want to dismiss them in any way. As Bridget said, the group arrived at a consensus position that biomass phase two has to occur, but there was disagreement over how to get there and how fast to move and what we should be looking at. The facts really are the best illustration of why we need to move. The supply study recently by the Olympic National Natural Resources Council Group estimated 2.1 million bone dry tons of forest biomass a year. Now, add about 40% more for the weight of water. The power plants that are currently in permitting right now on the Olympic Peninsula will require about 1.35 million dry tons a year. And again, add 45% more weight. Just the Adage plant, Shelton, has estimated they will consume 43 tons per acre. Excuse me, that there are 43 tons per acre of forest biomass on the peninsula. So essentially, if you add up all the plants, it's about all the megawatts. That's about 31,000 acres per year of biomass will be affected by these plants working together. That at 30 tons a truckload is about 45,000 truckloads. Going 20 to 30 miles to transport this material. It could be a very large operation, much more than the rules that we currently have that deal with leaving sites after forestry. The biomass supply studies and the UW folks are going to be helpful in estimating supply, but it's going to be a very rough estimate because you can't figure out what the supply is going to be until you know what you need to leave behind. And we think that that needs to be informed by science. It needs to be informed by stakeholders. We need to know where we're going with this. We think that we've talked to experts and we believe there's soil nutrient deficit issues. There's wood that needs to be left for erosion, sedimentation, water quality and water temperature and turbidity issues, down wood for wildlife, amphibians, wider forest roads for these trucks and more truck traffic. We have very serious concerns that the standard rules themselves will not support the kind of industry that I just mentioned, touching 31,000 acres per year when we're up to speed. I'd like to second those folks who said at the task force meeting that we should get ahead of this. We should not send out a signal that there's an unlimited amount of supply out here. We should not scale up large and then work backwards for the next 10 to 15 years like we do in so many other natural resource issues. This is an opportunity to be collaborative and informed by science. It is a good time to get going on the right footing on this. And we really can do this right and have a great opportunity to do it right, unlike a lot of other natural resource issues where we find ourselves a couple of decades down with a real problem on our hands. So let's work together and do this, but it's got to be done that way. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate the extra time and the opportunity to speak to phase two.
Okay. Thank you. We have one other person that signed up, and that's Adrian Miller. Good afternoon, Adrian.
Good afternoon, Commissioner, board members. WFPA continues to support the rulemaking process before the board to create a clear regulatory base for these biomass activities. We are also encouraged by the department's effort in addressing some of the data gaps surrounding the issue of supply through their ongoing supply study. And we also appreciate the department moving forward on their commitment made at the last forest practice board meeting to convene a group of stakeholders to identify concerns and begin the process of addressing those concerns with a sound basis in fact. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for that, Adrian. So with that, I think we're ready to move into the next item. That concludes the members of the public who signed up to comment on rulemaking. So I'll ask Gretchen to come forward and bring us up to date on where we are with rulemaking on forest biomass. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chairman Goldmark and members of the board. I am Gretchen Robinson and I work in the Forest Practices Division of DNR. And today I'm requesting your approval to continue with your forest biomass rulemaking. And the next step in rulemaking is to file the language with the code revisor for publishing in the Washington State Register and to conduct a public review and comment process. So the rule itself adds the words or forest biomass to the definition of forest practice in WAC 222.16.010, the definitions chapter. And the goal of the rulemaking is to make it clear that the harvest of forest biomass is a forest practice, and that it is therefore subject to all of the environmental protections provided in the forest practices. Last November, you directed staff to distribute proposed rule language for early review to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and counties and tribes, and that's a Forest Practices Act requirement. And that review took place in November and December, and the board received two comment letters in support of the rule proposal, one from Department of Fish and Wildlife and one from the Lummi Indian Business Council. And I sent those letters to you in your board packet. In the meantime, DNR staff completed a preliminary cost-benefit analysis and a small business economic impact statement. And we're also completing a CEPA checklist in anticipation of your direction today to proceed. So if you do direct staff today to proceed with public review, we will file the language for publication in the Washington State Register. We'll distribute the CEPA checklist for public review, and we will plan three hearings. We're thinking about three hearings across the state, three different locations of the state, and that they will take place in late March. So with the public review and commenting completed in late March, the board will be able to consider adopting a rule at the May 8th board meeting. So I now request that you direct staff to file the proposed language and a CR 102 to continue the rulemaking process.
Thank you, Gretchen. Questions? Proposed action would be appropriate now if someone's inclined. You can make a motion and we can discuss it. We can discuss it and then somebody can make a motion.
Is our motion drafted?
It's
coming.
That's what we're waiting for.
Okay.
Wait for it. Dave,
move. Since I'm in the best seat here, move that the Forest Practice Board approve the draft rule proposal that amends WAC 222.16.010 for public review and direct staff to file CR 102 with the Office of Code Revisor to initiate permanent rulemaking.
Second.
Your proposal adds language to the definition of forest practice to make it clear that harvest of forest biomass is subject to the same resource protection measures as timber harvest and the forest practice rules.
Second.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion properly supported to adopt the motion that's there for everybody's review. Discussion on the motion. Norm.
I would just like to point out to the board members and to the audience that, in fact, this is the way in which the Department of Natural Resources is regulating the removal of biomass, even at this time, without that clarification, at least on the Olympic region that I can speak to personally. All biomass harvest removal is considered a forest practice and is subject to all of the rules that regulate all other forest practices, achieving the same protections as would be achieved for all other forest practices. So I think this helps clarify. It's a good thing to have. We can all sleep well at night knowing that that this is done, but we haven't solved the world's problems because it pretty much was being done correctly up until this time. This just helps make it clear.
On a voluntary basis?
No, on a regulatory basis. On a regulatory basis, the transportation, the utilization of machinery off-road, all of those aspects that are regulated under the forest practices rules, the requirement to leave downwoody debris, the requirement to leave snags, the requirement to stay out of riparian zones, all of those are being enforced relative to forest biomass harvest removal currently. And this clarifies it to make sure that it is included and there's no wiggle room anywhere for anybody.
Good. Other questions, Stephen?
I just wanted to note that you had Ecology's concurrence with this proposal at this time.
All right, thank you.
I just wanted to note that I think this is a very good step, but I also acknowledge that there is a lot of public interest in the next phase, and as a board member, I will take those discussions seriously, and then we'll pay attention to that going forward.
Okay, we have a motion. It's properly supported. We have discussion. Call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion, raise your hand. Thank you, board members. That's unanimous. Thank you, Gretchen. Thank you for the good work that's taking us to the next step on this ruling. So moving on then to our next rulemaking as an opportunity for public comment on riparian open space program rulemaking. And we have one individual who signed up to make comment on this, and that's Robert Meyer, otherwise known as Bob. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Commissioner and members of the board. My name is Robert Meyer. I am the manager of Forest Policy and Environment for Rainier. We manage about 380,000 acres, mostly on the coast of Washington. I do want to say that I've probably been involved in every legislative, every proposal, every committee that has ever discussed riparian open spaces since the very beginning. So, as I start my comments, back in 1998, after one of the very last forest and fish negotiations, Jeff Van Duzer and I were assigned the task of developing the first outline of the riparian open spaces program for forests and fish. We were creating a compensation program for landowners who were extraordinarily and unevenly economically impacted by the forest and fish rules. We had no idea of the true conservation impact of the small program would have. It wasn't long before we would understand that impact. In a conservation transaction that had previously been blocked by low appraisal values caused by harvest restrictions on channel migration zones, this was as a result of forest and fish law and rules, the program was used to justify a higher appraisal value, and the conservation acquisition was completed. Eventually, well over 5,000 acres of commercial forest land was moved into conservation status, even though it was only hundreds of acres of riparian zone that were affected by this program. The program had created an ecosystem market. for harvest-restricted channel migration zones. Today, the Ho River Trust manages a significant portion of the lands along the Ho River. Most of the funding came from other programs. But the most important thing, the trigger that caused the transactions, was from the Riparian Open Space Program. It had created the ecosystem market and changed the way the properties were appraised. This program can do the same thing for conservation of spotted owl and marbled murrelet habitat. Instead of a negative regulatory approach, which we've tried for the last 20 years, we can move to a conservation strategy which will provide protection, restoration, enhancement, expansion, and connectivity of the most critically important habitats, just as it did for the Ho River. You are creating an ecosystem services market for T&E species habitat, one that will advance conservation well beyond the riparian open space program. I urge you to move forward. Our job is not yet done, and I'm personally working to expand this approach to other conservation programs. And we all need to come together to seek the needed funding to move this conservation program to become the great conservation tool that it can become for owls and murrelets and other T&E species here in Washington. So I would urge you to move forward with this program. Thank you very much. I would like to hand out a brochure that the last page talks about the Ho River transaction very briefly, but we're very proud of that conservation effort, and so I'll hand that out to the board, if I may. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. So moving on then, that completes the opportunity for public comment on this rulemaking. So next I would ask Dan to come up and present the Riparian Open Space Program rulemaking, our next step on this, please. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Dan Pomeroy. I'm the Conservation Easement Program Specialist for the Forest Practices Division. And I'm here today to request the board's approval to file a CR-102, the proposed rulemaking for the Riparian Open Space Program. In the board packet you have in front of you are the current versions of the draft proposed rule language, the preliminary cost-benefit analysis, and small business economic impact statement. As a reminder to the board, this rule is exempt from a SEPA analysis. If the board approves of filing the CR-102, staff will schedule public meetings to be held sometime in late March.
Thank you. Do we have some model language, please, on this particular rulemaking?
Yes.
Questions for Dan? So this is our second step on this one. If somebody wants to get the discussion going, it would be appropriate to make the motion.
Make the motion. I move that the Forest Practices Board approve the draft rule proposal that amends portions of Title 222 WAC relating to the expansion of the Riparian Open Space Program for public review and direct staff to file the CR-102 at the Office of the Code Advisor to initiate permanent rulemaking. This rulemaking incorporates provisions of 2009 Substitute Senate Bill 5401. And I'll let somebody second.
Is there a second for the motion?
I'll second.
Okay, Paul, thank you. Mm-hmm.
So I have a question about the language up here. We've changed the name of the program through this rulemaking, so I'm just wondering whether that should be reflected in the motion to the rivers and the Habitat Open Space Program.
It hasn't changed yet.
The current title is Riparian Open Space Program, and the proposed language.
Okay.
So this is draft.
Yes, this is draft.
Is just a draft. And there will be comment.
Yeah.
And so the final language will come next.
Right. And you have ecology's concurrence on this proposal.
Thank you.
Sure. Dan, maybe I'm missing something, but would you explain to me what Senate Bill 5401 did? How does this rulemaking incorporate provisions of that?
If I can remember, I didn't bring my notes on that.
I know, I don't remember.
Yeah, there was a couple elements in that. For one, expanded the channel migration zones from only avulsing channels
to
channel migration zones. It also incorporated habitat other than CMZ. So it was originally just for channel migration zones, and now it's going to be channel migration zones as well as.
Okay, so that was the bill that authorized the T&E into riparian. Gotcha.
So we are implementing this rule to adopt that language, and that's why this rulemaking is exempt from certain other requirements.
Thank you.
So that's
the
highlights.
Other questions from the board? All right. Hearing none, we have a motion properly supported. Ask for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please, on the motion. Okay, again, that's unanimous. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Welcome.
It's pretty straightforward, and we appreciate staff's help in moving this rulemaking along. So the next item on this afternoon's agenda is an opportunity for public comment on watershed analysis rulemaking. Thank you. We have two sign-ups for this particular one. Scott Swanson, please. Good afternoon, Scott.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Commissioner and Board. I appreciate this chance to come today again, as I have been today, in support of rulemaking that is ongoing. And in interest of saving time, Adrian just asked me to let you know that not only am I speaking for Westport Kimber, but I will be speaking for WFPA at the same time. I've really been thankful for the chance to be involved with the Board Manual Language Committee that's been going forward on watershed analysis as this rule language is being considered at the same time. And in getting prepared for that, I talked to Board Member Dave Summers just earlier that I had a chance to review a 1992 VHS video, and Dave was one of the stars of watershed analysis methodology, and Nancy Sterling was too, and I think some others here at the board level were also on that video. But the one other thing that I wanted to be thankful for and bring forward to the board today was the fact that I'm now realizing that because of this process, even though it's been ongoing and during the time, Westport Timber has had a chance to review two watersheds during that time. We've also found that we have a new generation of DNR employees that know much more about the watershed analysis process and is willing and able, it seems, to be helpful in moving it forward. So I've been appreciative of the numbers that have been working on it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Adrian, are you still want to? Okay. That's once is enough. Thank you. We like brevity this afternoon with a long agenda. Appreciate it. So that completes our opportunity for public comment on watershed analysis rulemaking. And with that, I'd invite staff to come forward. Sherry, thank you for your efforts on this particular rulemaking.
You're welcome. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the board. We now turn to watershed analysis, and I'm pleased to be here to ask for approval to move this rulemaking into the public review process. This rule is intended to ensure that watershed analysis prescriptions remain protective enough to warrant exemption from Class 4 special classification, which requires CEQA review. At your last meeting, you directed staff to circulate draft proposed rule language for the 30-day review and comment by Department of Fish and Wildlife, the counties, and affected Indian tribes. The board received two comments: support from Department of Fish and Wildlife, and recommendations from the Lummi Indian Business Council. You also received a letter from a private landowner, Westport Timber. The Lummi Indian Business Council commented that watershed analysis prescriptions must be more protective than the rules, that changes to the rules that are subsequently more protective than prescriptions must supersede those prescriptions, and ultimate plans should not supersede prescriptions that are more protective than the rules. Having looked through the current and the proposed rules, staff believes that they currently do address these concepts, and so as outlined in my memo to you that's in your board packet, staff recommended no changes to the language. So, compared to the 30-day language you reviewed in November, what is in the language that you have in your board packet? Mostly clarifications and cleanups by the Forest Practices Division staff, and some changes that were made at the policy, January policy committee meeting. All these I consider clarifications. A couple specifics. We re-reviewed where we had inserted the term reanalysis throughout the watershed analysis chapter, and that term is now used only where necessary or beneficial to specifically call out the reanalysis process. In doing this, this eliminated one WAC from the proposal, and that was the WAC on multi-year permits. Cleanup includes spelling out numbers, spelling landowner as one word, incorporating a previous rulemaking that changed the term local government to local government entities, and deleting the old phrase, when effective, in regards to the forest and fish rules. Also, on the top of page 2 of your rule, somehow a riparian open space WAC jumped into the middle of the board practices of the watershed analysis rule proposal. So that WAC will be deleted. And during
that's
this,
what that was.
Yes, yeah. Made you think, huh? And we are continuing, we will continue to ensure that we have not overused or underused reanalysis and that we have clear proposed rule language. So we're looking forward to receiving comments from the upcoming hearings. Having said all that, if you decide to initiate public review of the watershed analysis rulemaking, staff will file a CR-102 with the Code Revisor's Office, along with the Small Business Economic Impact Statement, which is part of the preliminary economic analysis in your board packet, conduct seeker review, and schedule hearings to coincide with the biomass and the riparian open space hearings. At this point, I'm happy to answer any questions you have about the proposed rulemaking. And DNR economist Craig Calhoun is here to answer any questions you have about the preliminary economic analysis.
Okay, questions? David?
Specific to the Lummies comment to the board, the way I read their letter is, I mean, what this rule does is it's giving landowners options who have watershed analysis to decide whether they want to do a reanalysis, correct?
Yes.
And if they don't, then DNR is free to take the action to basically remove those prescriptions if they are no longer, you know, go back to standard rules, in essence, class 4 special rule. So the way I read the Lummy letter is it was asking, are there instances where a prescription might be eliminated that actually provides for a landscape? And since we're mostly focusing on mass wasting issues here, where they had identified a landscape that we may not have under the class 4 special rule, and identify prescriptions associated with that landscape. Is there a possibility that we could lose some more protective prescriptions as a result of this process?
Having heard all of that, we will double check and okay. See if there is a gap someplace.
Okay,
thank you.
Darren, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do. I think it's possible, but unlikely. If you recall, the rule identified landforms in the standard rules resulted from all of the watershed analyses that were completed by department, by landowners, whomever might happen to initiate. So I think the chances of a landform being in a watershed analysis that would not get caught as part of a rule-identified landform through a review of an application that triggered the Class 4 special class, I think is pretty remote. But we have not gone through every watershed analysis, looked at every prescription and every landform. And I can honestly tell you we will not be able to do that. So there's a bit of a risk calculation here. I think that by going, if a watershed analysis does revert to standard rules, I think the risk, the chances of risk going up from that by reverting to standard rules is very slight and probably not worth going through every single prescription and every watershed analysis to try to compare. Because if you recall, the standard rule process doesn't have a specific prescription.
Right.
It's a review that may result in a prescription on the ground through that process. So it's difficult to compare apples to apples in that regard.
Perhaps perhaps a better way to address this issue is if you remove prescriptions as a result of a reanalysis not being done, would DNR still use that information in their application process in that watershed?
Absolutely.
Just like we would when prescriptions are draft or interim.
All right, thank you for that. We have some proposed language here, please. It might be appropriate again to make a motion and then we can have discussion on the motion.
Chair, I move the Forest Practice Board approve the draft rule proposal that amends portions of Title 222 Washington Administrative Code pertaining to watershed analysis for public review and direct staff to file a CR 102 with the Office of the Code Advisor to initiate permanent rulemaking. This rulemaking amends rules to ensure that the watershed analysis prescriptions continue over time to be protective enough to warrant an exemption for Class 4 special classification.
I hear a second.
Second.
Okay, thank you. We have a second to the motion. I hope this board understands how important this particular rulemaking process is. I think we all know that we have some watershed analysis that have gone past the five-year renewal period, and that this is a process that a committee of the board brought back to us some months past to correct what has become a deficiency. And I'm hopeful that the board will see fit to pass this 102 and keep moving forward on this particular rulemaking to take care of this problem that's developed over time. Yes.
You have the ecology concurrence on this rule, on this proposal. Second comment is I understand staff continue to find editorial challenges with this rule, and I certainly expect them to use their editorial expertise to continue.
Refine it?
Yes.
Okay. And that's obviously ongoing. Again, this is draft language, folks. This is not the final language. And it seems that at every iteration, we are finding ways to improve it. Questions? Norm?
Just a comment in support. Thank the staff and the board for bringing this rule forward that met the objectives of our task group and helped to solve that resource protection issue that was brought forward relative to the existing rule, and this helps to fix that.
Great. Okay, hearing no other questions, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. That's unanimous. Thank you very much, Ford, for that, and thank you, staff, for that presentation.
You're welcome.
So then, on watershed review and prioritization process, we have an update for the board. Leslie and Mark.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and board members. I'm Leslie Lingley, and I work in the Forest Practices Division as the science team lead. In your packet, I gave you two or three attachments that go along with my memo. And in May 2010, the board asked Forest Practices to do a number of tasks and to report back to you how we analyzed those tasks and took your direction. And one of the things that you asked me to do was to prioritize the watershed analyses with a bunch of criteria that you had established. So you gave me what the criteria was, but you didn't, and you let me figure out how we were going to determine the prioritization from that. So in your attachment A, I'm just going to go over real quickly. One of the things you wanted to do was the potential threat to public safety. When with 52 watershed analyses and trying to figure out where the public safety areas are, we decided to use the background rate for landslides in each of the watershed analyses. So we took the landslides that were in the watershed analyses inventories and then normalized those by area, and then again normalized by the years of photo records that they had, so that we would have a standard rate for background landslides. And so the ones that had the highest background rates got a number one, and as the rates went down, the ranks went up. So if you were number one, you were had the most landslides. And so that's how this spreadsheet works. So the next criteria was the activity level in the watershed. So we had all the numbers for all the FPAs that had been submitted since 1995 till 2010 for every watershed, and then we normalized that for the area for each watershed, and on for the ranking. The significant storm events that produced high landslides, the Division of Geology and Earth Resources had done a reconnaissance air photo census of landslides that occurred in many of the watersheds that were affected by the 2007 and 2009 storms. And out of those, in 2007, there were only four watersheds that were affected, and in 2009, there were five that were affected. So we added those to this ranking scheme. And then we asked for stakeholders to give us their priority watersheds that they thought were important to them for various reasons. And then we took those watersheds that they provided, and I think we had five of those. So when you add up all the rankings, the lowest number is then the number one number. So that's what you're seeing on this ranking sheet. So do you have any questions about that?
So you went, if I can just clarify here, you went through, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different metrics.
Right.
And then you just did a strict numerical calculation as to how the ranking fell out of that.
Exactly.
Okay. And from that, now the board sees this priority ranking of 1 through 42.
Right. And it's 1 through 42 because I was kind of surprised too, but as you did all the rankings, some of them had the same rank, even though when you add them all up, one might have had number one and one might have had number four, but the number four would have had one and the number one would have had four. So it came out to five. So you'll see on the priority ranking that there's two tens, there's two 17, three 17s, there's a couple of 21s, and that's just the way it fell out. And I wasn't going to try to, by myself, to decide which one was more important. So that's how, I just did it qualitatively, quantitatively, and then just took what we had.
So then, can you tell the board how you would use these rankings going forward, please?
Yes. So your second sheet, the attachment C has the rankings, and what we did was, one of the other tasks we did, which was the second task, was to try to figure out how many of the landowners in each of these watershed analyses areas would be willing to do a reanalysis. And so we sent out a request so that we could get a feeling how many people would want to do a reanalysis and how many people would want to opt out and use standard rules. So the second sheet here has watersheds in the bottom where people had already, everybody in the watershed had agreed that they were not going to do a reanalysis. They would like to opt out to standard rules. And then Murray Pacific, as you've seen, you've heard it's Westport Timber now, and they have come to the board a number of times in regards to their continuing five-year reviews that they've done ever since they started watershed analysis. So we didn't put them in the ranking because they already have a schedule, they've already been on schedule, they've never missed a schedule, and so they're not in this ranking. And so now we have the ones on the top that have that we're going to rank. This is the ranking that we have. And the next thing we need to do is to determine, ask the landowners again. You can see how many landowners have not responded to our inquiry about whether or not they wanted to do the reanalysis. And most of that was, as I've talked to a lot of landowners, they wanted to know what the reanalysis process was going to be before they wanted to let us know if they wanted to opt out or not. So we still have a number of landowners that haven't made that decision, and they'll probably be able easier to make that decision when we finalize the implementation reanalysis process. And that process has been going on ever since July with numerous stakeholder meetings, and the last review is out right now, and we're having our next meeting on the 15th to finalize
that. So if I can, just to remind the board that what Leslie's describing here is the fact that there are stale analysis out there, and when this rule is adopted, then DNR will have the capacity to either dialogue with the underlying landowner in the area as to whether they want to take the off-ramp, which is basically to go to current rule, or whether they want to go through the process of updating their analysis to current science standards. So that's basically the question that she's talking about, dialoguing with them about.
Right. And we're going to try to see if we can get a response from the landowners by April 1st, so then we'd be able to reprioritize the top part of this list, because maybe some of these are going to fall out. So this is kind of it's really a draft list until we find out exactly who's going to do it and who's not. But this is the list that we're working with right now. So we decided that we could do four. It depends on who these people are who are going to do it, but we figured we could probably, or my staff could probably handle the review of these watershed analyses about eight to ten a year. So because I have five staff, each person can do two in a year, and it's probably going to take that much time, 6 months, for a reanalysis to do. And so some of these are going to change a little bit, but if we can do 8 to 10 a year, then we get probably through this list in a couple of years.
So again, this is new work.
Yes,
this is reanalysis. Work that has not been going on in the past.
That's correct.
But this is work that we feel we must do to make sure that we get these analyses correct.
Correct.
Questions from the board?
Clarifying. For the landowners that were invited to respond, what was the threshold of their ownership within the watershed?
We only sent the letters out to landowners that had 10% or more of the non-federal forest lands in their watershed. And that was the exact same requirement for doing watershed analysis in the beginning, in the original watershed analysis.
Thank you.
Sherry?
Actually, I was just pointing at
Stephen.
He had his hand up.
Oh.
Sorry. Two questions, please. One is, for the ones that DNR did as a regulator in the 90s, mm-hmm. So if no one steps up in those basins, what is the plan there? And also, we had some that were jointly done with the Forest Service. What are your
right.
plans there?
I asked the Forest Service, and then we haven't gotten any responses back from them, because that was in the 90s, that was kind of a collaborative thing that Forest Service was doing. They did part of it, and then they didn't go to the prescriptions like we did. And the DNR, so even if their Forest Service and DNR was the sponsor, DNR is going to opt to go to standard rules on the ones that with DNR regulatory sponsored. And I've already had conversations with State Lands, and State Lands sponsors of 5 watershed analyses, they would also like to go to standard rules, because on their HCP, right now they go to standard rules. They don't have rural prescriptions. They don't follow prescriptions. They do standard rules. So that's how that would work.
So you're making good progress in terms of analyzing and prioritizing.
Yes, I think we've got that finished, yes.
But it's a significant workload you're going to shoulder when you get started.
Probably.
There may be.
Yeah.
We will ask landowners to make that decision by April 1 as to whether they would like to perform a reanalysis or not. So based on their answers, we will set the priorities for those remaining watersheds, which will have a reanalysis, and then that will dictate the workload.
And I'm sure you'll come back and apprise the board after you get that additional data.
Absolutely.
That will be reported at the May meeting. In conjunction with the board's review of these rules for adoption. And then it would be set everything in place so that on July 1, when the rules become effective, the DNR at that point could remove prescriptions from those watersheds where reanalysis has been, we've identified the need for reanalysis and other landowners are choosing not to do that.
Other questions from the board? This is an information item.
I haven't been through this process before, so is there some way, or is it when you're doing one of these reanalyses, does all the staff work come from the department, or do the applicants and other participants in the watershed shoulder some of that? Or?
Right. The sponsors of the watershed analysis take the responsibility for providing the personnel and the funding to do the watershed reanalysis.
And your role is to?
We will provide training. We are pretty much at the last ends of the reanalysis, say board manual, I guess what we're going to call it, and how they're going to do the implementation of these reanalyses. And all of this stuff has been done with stakeholder review and every process. And then the regions will have some role to play in notifying everybody in the particular watersheds that there's going to have this process is going to happen. It's going to be pretty much like they did in the beginning, and so you ask for comments from everybody, and then you get your people in order, and then they do the analysis, and then in the end, DNR geologists will review the final products, and there'll be lots of opportunities for both for stakeholders and managers in those watershed analyses to help with any prescription rewrites if that happens to happen. So it's quite a process, and a lot of different people are involved in the watershed analysis process for this mass wasting reanalysis. And that will come, I mean, all those steps are in the reanalysis document that we've been working on also.
Steven?
So will DNR regulatory be on the prescription team as they have been in the past?
However it was in the past, yes.
Okay.
Be. Yeah.
And of course, you guys went on CEPA on these.
Right.
All of that.
Yeah. It's really important to have the DNR regulatory people there to determine if the prescriptions are implementable and are they reasonable, and do they think they can actually enforce them? So that's why we have DNR regulatory folks in the area.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the report.
You're welcome.
Making good progress there.
Thank you.
So moving on to the next item, RMAP. No, we're not going to get a break. It's not 325 yet. RMAP planning, rulemaking, and board manual update. Mark and Darren, please.
Good afternoon again. Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. We're going to do this in a two-step approach. Mark's going to talk about the status of the rulemaking and the components that go along with that. And I'm going to give an update on some of the work we've been doing in the operations shop to move the ball down the field on this topic. So coming out of the policy recommendation that came to the board, there was a number of things that were listed there that we needed to do or keep in mind as we moved the rulemaking forward. And a lot of those had to do with operationally how we implement RMAP. And some issues that were identified as part of the review with regard to annual reporting, the reporting elements, some inconsistencies in those elements, some lack of standardization in how reporting is done, et cetera. So we called together our RMAP specialists, of which there are five of them, spread across the six regions, and tasked them with coming up with a plan, an operational plan, that would meet the desires or the issues identified and the improvements recommended in the policy proposal that came to you a few months ago. So they started working in the late fall, early winter. We met several times over the winter and brought forward a report to the program. I believe it was in late November, early December, and we've been looking at it and talking with individual stakeholders about that since that time. And the plan contains several elements, some of the most important of which is to a way to standardize all of the reporting elements across all of the regions so that we're collecting them in a consistent fashion and reporting them out annually in a consistent fashion. To better identify the starting point with a couple of the elements, particularly fish passage barriers that need to be replaced and miles of road that need to be improved. And to come up with a data management system that was standard across all regions so that when information was fed into it and reported out, it was the same. If one person wanted to look in different regions, they'd be looking at the same type of information to be able to understand it better. So they have that draft plan and, that they submitted to us. We've been talking with individual stakeholders about that, what we're seeing and what we intend to do with it, getting some feedback. And we're going to fold all of that into the board manual process that's going to support the rulemaking. And I think, as you heard earlier from Mark and Donnell, we're starting that process this week. And it's going to be ambitious. We hope to deliver a completed board manual in May. So that's going to require a lot of work because there are several areas where we need to update the board manual to support implementation of the extension. And it's mostly, as I said, going to be around the reporting element, standardizing those, what type of forms to use, standardizing those, and providing a data input form that would be standard across all the regions. So that's what's going on the operations side. I know that was a quick summary, so I'll ask if any questions before Mark talks about the rulemaking and the board manual.
Okay, first, I hope that we didn't leave any confusion in the previous summer update for watershed analysis. DNR will not take any action on watershed analysis until the rules are effective. I may have not made that real clear, but the board will adopt rules in May. Then when I said reference July 1, that would be the time frame in which the rules become effective. It's at that time then the DNR will review those watershed prescriptions or mass wasting prescriptions in watersheds where the landowner does not choose to do a reanalysis. So with that said, we'll move on to the rulemaking portion of our maps.
as the board is aware, there's a lot of staff work that's associated with rulemaking besides just the actual rule language. And in order to complete all of the documents, we need data. So in the case of RMAPs, there were known deficiencies with the 2009 data. We wanted to wait until the 2000 data became available. That is now beginning to come in. I believe that we will have the data that we need by the end of February. We have initiated the SEPA checklist, the environmental review. When that is completed, then we will forward that to the responsible official to review to make a determination of either of significance or non-significance. And that will then dictate when we bring forward to the board the request for the board to review the rule and the draft cost-benefit analysis and direct staff to file the CR-102 and initiate the rulemaking process. We have not started the cost-benefit analysis again because we need the full data, and in this case, we do need the benefits of the environmental analysis as well. So that's also a very, very short, quick summary. Are there any questions of the board?
So please, Mark, describe for the board why an environmental analysis is required with this rulemaking and not with other rulemaking that the board is disengaging.
Because of the direct potential impact to public resources, in this case with the aquatic resources from the RMAPs, of course, is the bringing of all forest roads up to the forest and fish standards, or the new rule standards. And that's also including all of the water crossing structures and road map.
And how long will the environmental analysis process take?
We are nearly complete with the environmental checklist. Again, we're waiting for the 2010 data. We're going to review that data because it was what we had in 2009 and make sure that we bring forward the most current data. We want to have the kind of the qualitative analysis and SEPA and the quantitative and the cost-benefit analysis based on the same data. And we want it as current as possible and with minimization of errors that were found in the collection of the 2009 data.
I guess I would add that while the SEPA checklist is nearly complete, and Mark mentioned we want to basically check our analysis that we have completed so far with the 2010 data when we have it in hand, the real driver on the timeline is the decision, the threshold determination on SEPA. That will drive the timeline completely on this process once we're through that. If there's a threshold determination of non-significance, it's likely we can bring the whole package to you in May. If there is a determination of significance, then that's not going to be the case because an EIS will be required. How long that takes depends on several things. Do we have the funding in hand immediately to initiate a process to hire someone to conduct an environmental impact statement? Can we get that through the process we have in place with OFM in order to spend that money on that task, and just how long does that task take? The only point of reference we have, a recent point of reference we have on this, is the RMAP rule change that occurred in 2005 or 6, the small land, we went to a checklist for small landowners. That's our most recent point of reference on just how much an EIS costs and how long it takes. And Mark, if I remember right, that was about $150,000 and took us about a year to complete. And I'm hopeful that this won't be the case this time because we've got a lot of information in the queue, so to speak, to support that kind of effort should we have to do it. But it will take some time because there's lots of process steps we have to go through in order to make that thing happen.
Questions for the board, from the board. This is a little different rulemaking because of the different requirements. This involves a lot of public resource, potentially. I think we know that. All right. Well, thank you very much for the report. So we have one additional agenda item on today's agenda. I want to thank the board for working diligently with us as far as we've gotten. The remaining item is future work session topics. I think you will all recall that at the last meeting, we acknowledged that we're going to work diligently to stay on these four meetings a year. And because of that, we're going to have to learn to work within the confines of these four meetings to carry out whatever planning that needs to be done at this particular time in our agenda. So that's what this agenda is designed to provide, is for this board to consider future work session topics or topics that are now apparent to board members that we should discuss as to whether we need to put them on our work plan. I think one issue came up earlier today. I thought one issue did come up today that I thought we were going to discuss today, but maybe I'm...
If the board members small landowner template, is it going to come back at the next meeting? Is that the one you're taking?
No, I don't. I think that one's in queue.
It's in the queue.
That one's in queue. I think, so just to review, we have a heavy rulemaking workload that we're involved in now. We also have a heavy workload of periodic reports around a variety of different activities the board is involved in. We saw some of those today. On an annual basis, we're apt to see a half a dozen or more of those different reports. So are there things that the board is concerned about now that we're not addressing? I think that's the purpose of this time allotment today, is to see if there are things that anybody thinks that we should be doing that we're not addressing. We've certainly got a pretty broad work schedule right now. Steve.
Commissioner, I have several items that should be considered when appropriate. That we may want to think about bringing to the board. I know all the board members received a memo from council on NEDC versus Brown, and at some point in the future, if you need to bring that issue to the board, I'd like to work with you, or ecology would like to work with you, and in doing that, I don't see a need for that right now, because there's nothing going on. It's sometime in the future. The same thing there's another item also that may or may not need to come to the board, but I just wanted to make the board aware of it. EPA is considering, they're in the process of issuing an aquatic pesticides permit. And we're very fortunate in that when we did the forest and fish rules, we upgraded our pesticide rules so that we have buffers on buffers. So this should not be an issue for us, but I just wanted to give everyone a heads up that depending on what the final permit looks like, or ecology will report back to you if there is any consequences for our state. Third, as was mentioned earlier today, the 2541 process that your department will be initiating this year on incentives. I would hope that as that process starts, that we would get reports back to the board as it goes forward. And I think I'll just leave it at that. Okay.
Thank you. Those are all good suggestions. Paula?
So we had a brief discussion about potentially needing some more time on owls, depending on the outcome of the recovery plan.
Right.
So having some time for that. There was some discussion on water typing that's sort of wrapped into the compliance monitoring, so I don't know if that's something that needs to be called out specifically or if that's going to fit within that topic.
I would suggest that's going to fit within the compliance monitoring. That was a major component of the report, and I know staff will be addressing that in their recommendations.
And then there's a there was a recommendation that came out of the Washington State Forest Carbon Working Group. And this may be a topic that is later in the year, possibly in 2012, but the possibility of looking at CEPA implications for CO2 emissions from conversion. So Stephen can speak, he formulated the recommendation for the rest of the group, but it's a topic that could fall under our purview.
Yes. As you know, members of the board, hopefully, any minute now, you should be able to get the new report from the Forest Climate Work Group. And within that work group report, there is a recommendation that a conversation take place, not necessarily at the board meeting, but with stakeholders to discuss whether there should be further guidance on CEPA when conversions occur, with specific attention to the increased greenhouse gas emissions that take place as a result of forest land to non-forest uses.
And I brought it up because the results of that stakeholder discussion should be something that the board is helping by, so because it could involve the class four general.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay, we'll take note of that one as well. Anybody else? I think we've got a pretty good work schedule for the year over a broad diversity of topics that are, as we heard today, broadly supported by the stakeholders. And I think that's a result of good work done by the subcommittee that worked on the RMAP issue, and I'm sorry, on the watershed analysis issue, and brought forward something that was broadly workable. I think there's some important lessons for the board here about ways to deal with difficult issues ahead of time, instead of trying to wrestle them here at the board level. So hearing no further concerns about workload, and the staff have taken notes about your comments. And again, I want to thank you all for your contributions to the board and for your contributions for making today a meeting that we could that we could close ahead of schedule. We're adjourned.